Chapter 8. I did not sleep well that night. I was tired, but my thoughts were too agitated. My mind was too full of all that Stafford had told me, of this past that had suddenly become a part of my own story, where before there had been only a blank. I feared now that Stafford might decide he did not want to continue. Even as he seemed to take some pleasure in recounting them, it had been clear that the memories pained him, too. Perhaps he would feel that it was not worth that pain. If he did, could I simply return to London and carry on as though nothing had happened? I did not want to contemplate it. I rose gratefully as the first suggestion of the day began to show itself through the window. Dressed in my swimming costume and cut-offs, slung my Nikon around my neck and crept from the bedroom into the hallway without. I padded through the sleeping house, looking about me with furtive curiosity. I had expected to see Stafford's work everywhere, but save for a small landscape study in my room, there was none in evidence. This spoke to me of the modesty of the man. Instead, there were photographs. Many of them were of a solemn child who I realized, with a shock of recognition, had to be Oliver. His black hair and sharp chin lent him a fey appearance. There he was with Stafford in a dinghy, a smile transforming his face, with a dark, smiling older woman who I assumed was Stafford's wife, and another woman who was much younger, beautiful, I supposed, in a poised, heavily coiffed way. She rested one small white hand on the child's shoulder, but otherwise stood apart from him. This had to be Oliver's mother. They shared the same eyes, almond-shaped, heavy-lidded. There was something odd about her. I couldn't put my finger on it precisely, but it was to do with the way she seemed to gaze out of the frame to a point beyond your shoulder, as though scoping her escape. When I stepped outside, the air was cool, though the cloudless sky suggested that it would be another searingly hot day. The moon was still visible, way up in the violet reaches, a pale sickle-shaped sliver. The sea, too, looked purplish at this hour, deep and dark, less benign than it had seemed in the full light of day. I lifted my camera and framed the scene, but felt unusually frustrated by the limitations of my art. I wanted to capture it all, the scent of herbs, the hush of the breeze, the tentative warmth of the newly risen sun on my bare shoulders. I wondered if this was something Stafford might experience too, when he sat down to try and render it in paint. I'd go for a swim, I decided. It was early enough that I could hope to have the pool to myself. I picked my way down the steps Stafford had indicated. The stone was coarse as pumice beneath my soles, and desiccated in places, falling away before me in miniature avalanches of scree. When I reached the pool, I saw that it was a modest size, but quite deep. The very fact of its creation gave cause for wonder. It had been carved out of the steel-grey rock of the cliff itself, which fell away on the far side towards the cove. There was no diving board and no stepladder, merely an unembellished tank of, I dipped a cautious toe in, ice-cold water. I shrugged off my shorts and laid them down several metres away with my camera and towel. Goose flesh washed my skin as I stood poised in indecision on the edge. Then, before I had any more time to think about it, I jumped. There was a shock, the smack of the surface, a rush of frigid water around my ears, and my feet touched the slick bottom. I shot back up, gasping and laughing to myself stupidly, my heart racing from the cold, my breath high in my chest, so I felt I couldn't draw enough air into my lungs. But almost immediately I started to acclimatise, and the temperature began to seem bearable. I dived and surfaced, shook my head like a dog, revelling in it. Good morning. I sputtered and blinked, disorientated. Water was dripping from my lashes, blinding me, but gradually a dark figure took shape at the top of the steps that led up from the beach. It was Oliver, I realised. I saw that he carried his camera around his neck. Oh, hello, I said, making an effort to be friendly. Have you been down on the beach? Yes. That was clearly all I was going to get. The other questions I had intended to ask, about the photographs he had taken down there, died on my lips. Then he gestured to the water. Aren't you cold? No, I said with some bravado. It's fine, once you're in. I was starting to cool down, though, I realised, and began to tread water to get my blood moving again.
Your lips are going blue.
All right, I conceded. It's freezing. In fact, come to think of it, I'm refreshed enough. Would you mind passing me my towel? Oliver picked it up and held it to his chest. I reached for it, but he stepped back.
You need to concentrate on getting out first. Here.
He put out his arm, apparently suggesting I take hold of it.
I keep telling Grandpère that he has to put some steps in.
Oh, don't worry. I'll be fine. Rather stubbornly, I decided that I did not want to accept his help. But when I surveyed the side, the small cliff of stone seemed suddenly intimidating and much steeper than I had realised. Eventually, accepting defeat, I relented and took Oliver's outstretched hand. He gave a haul and I pushed with my spare palm against the stone lip, feeling the water suck lovingly at my legs and belly before it released me with a rush, leaving me sprawling at his feet. I thanked him, pertly, making quick efforts to stand, but he merely pulled me up with another easy yank. My swing costume was school-regulation chased, a robust black fabric with a modest neckline. In terms of the amount it concealed, it was not so different from those suits worn by Victorian bathers, merely less flamboyant. All the same, I felt exposed before him, pale and scrawny. I looked down and realised that, despite its thickness, the material was doing a poor job of concealing my nipples, painfully erect with the cold. The whole experience was humiliating. It was as though an Olympian had stepped off his perch to offer a floundering mortal his divine assistance. I thought of the boy in the photographs with that sombre dark gaze. Could they really, I thought, be one and the same?
Why are you here?
His question was so unexpected that it threw me for a moment. There was an element of challenge in it, and suspicion. What do you mean? I asked, stalling for time. I retrieved my towel and wrapped it about me, an inadequate suit of armour.
My grandfather is a very private man.
It sounded like an accusation. Well, I said, he did invite.
People will try anything, he said, cutting me off. Absolutely anything at all to get in touch with him. It's ironic. The more he has tried to get away from people, the more eager they are to seek him out. You are an art student, aren't you?
I suddenly understood what he was accusing me of. You think I'm some sort of groupie? I said, and then I laughed because it was so ridiculous. He went to say something, but this time I got in first. You're wrong, I told him. It isn't anything like that.
What is it, then?
I gestured down at myself, at my sodden towel and goose-pimpling skin. I'm not sure this is the time to talk about it. He did not have to know that I had no intention of discussing it with him. Anyway, I decided, if Stafford had not felt it necessary to explain everything, it probably wasn't my place to do so. I looked up at him and saw that he was not convinced. One thing I can promise you, I said. This is about something important, something very close to my heart, and I think your grandfather's too. As I spoke, I held his gaze and felt triumphant when he was the first to look away. After he had gone, I realised that I was trembling slightly, and not merely from the cold. I was appalled that I had managed to incite such dislike in him, and so quickly. I told myself not to take it personally, yet no matter how much I tried to convince myself otherwise, it felt personal.
I salute you, said Stafford to me at breakfast. I've only ever gone in the heat of the day, when the water has had a chance to warm up. You are clearly made of sterner stuff.
We were eating at the table by the pool, and it glimmered before us, its depths once more inviting, now that I was warm and dry. Marie had navigated expertly down the stone staircase with a laden tray, batting away my rather futile attempt at assistance, and unloading a cornucopia of delights, hot rolls, fresh figs, coffee, a luminous golden pat of butter. Stafford and I talked while Oliver sat gazing out to sea, apparently lost in thought, making no effort to join our conversation. Every so often, Stafford would glance in his direction, though whether these were looks of concern or irritation, I could not tell. It was amazing. Here was a man who was at a guess in his early 30s, behaving like a sullen teenager. A temperament more different from Stafford's could not have been conceived. Clear evidence, I decided, for the prevalence of nature over nurture.
Kate, said Stafford, leaning across to refill my coffee cup, I had hoped that you and I might carry on our discussion after breakfast.
Yes, please, I'd like that. So he did want to continue, I thought, in relief.
Good. I thought that we could sit in the studio to avoid the heat, and I have an idea I'd like to put to you. I'll explain when we're there.
Oliver had turned to watch us now. It irritated him, I was sure, that his grandfather and I had something together from which he was excluded, and I could not help but feel a sort of childish triumph at this. The studio, rather like Stafford himself, was unexpectedly devoid of eccentricity and creative disarray. It was a cool white space filled with light. The vast windows prevented any sense of sterility, however, for they let the outside in. The sea and sky felt immediate and present. I looked about me. What a wonderful room. Stafford smiled.
My grandson is very talented. It was one of the first projects he undertook after he'd qualified. It's another signature of his, I think you could say, making in the enclosed space the point, not that which encloses it, so that the structure is simply incidental, a frame. You'll have to tell him you like it.
I nodded vaguely. Several large canvases were stacked against the far wall, but their board backs faced outwards so that no paint was visible. Stafford explained that these were works in progress, but that he didn't like to have them turned around unless he specifically chose to look at them.
Or they clamour at me, and I see all their mistakes. It makes me want to throw everything away and start again.
Perhaps, I thought, a certain well-concealed eccentricity was present here after all. There were two chairs in the room. One was clearly the artist's, with a contraption like a small easel fixed to an arm. The other chair faced it, as though in conversation.
I should explain my idea to you, said Stafford. Feel free to say no, but I thought that you might be prepared to let me make a study of you while we talk. I find I think and speak more freely while I'm working. It's always been that way.
Thomas Stafford, internationally renowned artist, was asking me to sit for him. The fact that he felt the need to ask for my approval was almost laughable. I didn't especially like the idea of it. I knew that I would no doubt disappoint as a sitter. But, more than anything, I was reassured. It seemed further proof that Stafford assumed I would be staying. I'd be honoured, I said, though I should warn you that I doubt I'll make a good subject. I've been told I don't take a good photo because I fidget, and I never know what to do with my face. I can't seem to hold an expression. I'm always happier to be on the other side of the lens, as it were.
None of that matters, Stafford said. If anything, I prefer it. A bit of movement translates well into a sketch. It helps to give the sense of strong, visible character. Alice was such a model, incapable of sitting still for any length of time. You can see it in the drawing that brought you here. It's my favourite thing about that work, the sense that it's an expression of a moment in time, that she is about to stand, to turn and jump into the water.
So I let myself relax into my chair as best as I was able, and Stafford picked up a stick of charcoal. I heard him describe long strokes onto the paper in front of him, once, twice, three times, and then he began to talk.
After the party, I was terrified of losing her again. I was going back up to Oxford, you see. I gave her my address at Magdalen, and she promised to write, but I'm not sure I believed her. I wasn't sure she would welcome my friendship. Inside, she might be the Alice that I remembered, but she was also a beauty, elegant, cultured, and fiercely intelligent. She would have real men, men of experience, vying for her company, while I was still just a boy. How could I hope to compete with that?